You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Vince Lombardi once said, "I have never had an outstanding successful athlete who is not a hard milk drinker," in a 1960s National Dairy Council ad. But now milk is losing its spot at the table. We'll learn how big dairy companies are counting on school lunches to help them in this tough time.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Attorney General Josh Call is saying he can't withdraw Wisconsin from a multi-state lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act after Governor Evers seemed to say otherwise.
Also in the news, Milwaukee is one of three finalists to host the 2020 Democratic National Convention, and the reaction has been swift and strong to news that American Family Insurance will be taking over the naming rights of what is currently Miller Park in Milwaukee.
Robert Mintzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, good to have you back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks.
Now, Rob, Governor Evers, made a campaign promise to get Wisconsin out of a multi-state lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act. His ability to do that was curtailed before he even took office, but he doubled down on it during his State of the State address. Here he is speaking on it on Tuesday.
That's why I'm announcing tonight that I have fulfilled the promise I made to the people of Wisconsin by directing Attorney General Call to withdraw from a lawsuit that would gut coverage for the 2.4 million Wisconsinites who have pre-existing conditions.
Now, as we know, that didn't exactly happen. So, Rob, what's the latest on where this stands?
Yeah, it's weird. You might think from hearing that clip that he had directed the attorney general to withdraw from the lawsuit, but it turns out no, and essentially nothing actually changed this week. So, we should take it in order, right? So, in the lame duck session, the Republicans passed these laws that you mentioned that limited the governor's power, and one of those was to say that the state attorney general could not withdraw from this federal lawsuit that would invalidate Obamacare. So then, in an interview before his inauguration, Evers said that, his expectation was that probably he'd end up being sued over his response to some of the lame duck laws. Then, of course, everyone wanted to know what he meant by that, and he didn't really say. So I think that observers were sort of ready for a sign that he would be, you know, in some way, like, defying those laws or, testing them in a way that would end up in court. So when he said in the State of the State address that he had made this direction to the Attorney General, it was interpreted as a challenge to the law, something that it would trigger a lawsuit and the courts would decide whether or not he had the right to make that direction, whether the laws in the lame duck period were constitutional or not. But then the next day, the governor said no, and today, even this afternoon, he made some public statements saying that in his mind, what he was saying was that they're going to do the process of requesting from the Joint Finance Committee permission to withdraw from the lawsuit. But of course, we all know the Joint Finance Committee is controlled by Republicans, so they're going to say no. So that's how we get back to nothing having changed this week.
So if that lawsuit succeeds and the Affordable Care Act is struck down, then guaranteed coverage for those with pre-existing conditions would go with it. And this week, a bill to ensure those protections here in the state passed the Assembly. So what's this bill's chance looking like?
Not great. I mean, this is so right. The Assembly passed the same bill essentially last year in the lame duck session, and then it did not pass in the state Senate. And it's not clear at all that there's that anything has changed in that situation. But this was the case. Yeah, the Assembly Republicans passed this bill, and there was a big messaging push. You saw, tweets and statements about their own personal connections to this issue. Coverage for pre-existing conditions has always been one of the most politically popular aspects of the Obamacare law. And so, this is why it became a huge, even central part of the gubernatorial race last year. And so Republicans in this way are trying to inoculate themselves from the charge that they want to throw out these protections. But it's like not, I don't see a path to this becoming law in the state. Maybe of limited use. What we know for sure, Durrell, is that we will get to have this exact same political debate for a while yet.
Robert Mintzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. We're talking about the news of the week in and around Wisconsin. Yesterday, Governor Evers announced $31 million in state support for Marinette Marine, one of Wisconsin's big shipbuilding companies. What's this money going towards?
Yeah, this is – so Marinette Marine is a big employer up north of Green Bay, almost to the UP, and they build ships for the U.S. military. These are giant multi-year, multi-billion dollar contracts that they compete for. But there are, like, other companies around the state that also bid for these and sometimes win the bids. So this – $31 million from the state would allow Marinette Marine to expand its shipyard and build some new infrastructure as they are competing for a $10 billion federal contract. It's going to be part of Evers' state budget. Also, probably important to say that this $31 million is contingent on getting that giant federal contract. So
sure.
So it won't go through if they don't get it.
Now, the city of Milwaukee is taking the final steps in its bid to host the 2020 Democratic National Convention. Talk about some of the latest moves that have been taking place over the last few weeks.
Right. So Milwaukee this week made their sort of final pitch. They're one of three finalists for this Democratic National Convention. The others are Miami Beach and Houston. And one piece of news this week was that the city got a line of credit that it can use kind of like as a backstop. I mean, this is Mayor Tom Barrett's case here is that this credit is privately guaranteed and would only kick in if Democratic fundraising didn't meet the $70 million or so that it's going to cost to have this thing in the city. So it's part of Barrett's pitch that this is all upside to the city of Milwaukee. But also, I mean, it's significant to have the city as one of those three finalists. And, it very well may be that Milwaukee has a good case to make to the Democratic Party.
Now, Rob, why do you think Wisconsin can be an attractive option politically when you look at Miami Beach and looking at Houston? What makes us stand out?
Yeah, so it's politics, right? It's hard to predict. The convention will be held in July of 2020, so the parties will make their decisions about where to hold them well in advance of that. But they tend to choose a place that's going to help them build a political story that they want to tell. And so, Miami Beach, Florida is an important swing state, but it did swing pretty red in 2018, where Wisconsin, which is certainly a swing state and super close in the 2016 election, has swung the other way toward Democrats in the years since. So, I think there could be a case that if the Democratic Party wants to build on strength and the like upper Midwest, maybe Milwaukee is a good choice.
And finally, perhaps the story that got the most attention this week was the news that American Family Insurance is taking over the naming rights of Miller Park. That has a lot of people fired up. Why do you think it struck such a chord?
People do not like change. I've had a hard time coming up with a really strong take on this myself, but I mean it's been Miller Park for a long time, and of course Miller Brewing ties into the Brewers, though the team is named after like the industry, not a particular company. I think the best idea, and I say this not only because it came from my boss's boss, but it did, is George Stanley, the editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and USA Today Network, wrote a piece proposing the name Hank Aaron Park after the famous slugger and former Milwaukee Brave and Brewer. and maybe, like, you know, throw in American Family in the name, American Family Field at Hank Aaron Park or something like that. Maybe that could make everyone happy.
Sounds like a good idea to me. Rob, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Rob Mintzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He was with us for our weekly check-in on news happening around the state. Big dairy companies and national organizations backed by them have long been pushing the benefits of milk to the public through ads and commercials. Remember the long-running Got Milk campaign? That's probably the reason you're familiar with the claim that calcium helps build strong bones.
And one source of revenue these companies have always relied on through the years was school lunch programs. But our next guest says finding the balance between supporting agribusiness and feeding healthful meals to kids is a challenge that hasn't quite been solved yet. Peter Robison is a writer for Bloomberg News and Bloomberg Business Week magazine. He specializes in long-form features and investigative articles. He wrote the piece headlined, Big Dairy is About to Flood America's School Lunches with Milk. Peter, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into this back and forth over the last few years on milk, you might think, okay, school lunches, we start off with the best science on nutritional information and we build our school lunch plans around that. But you say there's a lot more local, regional business and politics that goes into it. Give us a little bit of the broad background there.
That's a really good way of framing it. I got into this story because I was fascinated when President Trump's pick to be Agriculture Secretary, Sonny Perdue, about a week after he was confirmed, went to a school in Virginia and said he would be changing the school meal rules that President Obama had said, and he made a point of saying, I wouldn't be as big as I am today without chocolate milk. And Sonny Perdue himself had been a grain trader. That's where he made his fortune, and he was a consultant to milk producers. And we wanted to really dig into how things end up on the school lunch tray. And what we found is that businesses like dairy wield a lot of influence, and they wield it in part through a group called the School Nutrition Association, which represents lunch ladies, but it also gets a majority of its revenue from big food companies like Land O'Lakes, like Domino's Pizza, like PepsiCo. So the story tried to show, just as you said, that there's a balance between nutrition and the interests of agribusiness, which, of course, want to sell their products.
Let's dig into the milk story now. Obviously, an important issue here in Wisconsin. We hear about low milk prices for commodity producers, gluts of milk, in some cases cheese. What has happened with milk and other dairy products in school lunches in the Obama administration, now in the Trump administration?
One thing the Obama administration did, which might not seem like a big change, but it's been noticed by industry, was that the Obama administration said that if you served chocolate milk, it couldn't be 1%. It had to be skim. And they also required that water be available at every meal. So it sort of edged out this pride of place that milk has had for a long time in school lunches. And what the industry was finding was that some kids just didn't like the taste of skim chocolate, so they were drinking less of it. And Milk Pep, which is the national trade group which was behind the Got Milk ads, you know, found that kids were the source of the biggest volume drop from 2011 to 2015. So this was a change that they wanted to make happen.
Now, you tried to look at some of the arguments over nutrition. What did you find when you looked at the premise that milk of whatever sort is healthy stuff for school kids?
People have this, it's almost folklore that you know, milk is calcium, but increasingly studies have found that it may not be the bone protector that you think it is. There was a study done in Sweden that found that the people who were drinking, you know, three glasses of milk or more a day, compared to those who drank less than a glass, were actually more likely to die. And they also found that those people weren't any less prone to bone fractures. That was just one study, but there have been others that have found something similar.
And milk might be fine for many kids, but you also looked at, for a lot of people, depending on their genetic background, lactose intolerance might be a real obstacle to wanting to drink a glass of milk with lunch.
That's another thing, and it's something that's not widely understood if you're of Northern European descent, because genetically, Northern Europeans are able to process milk more easily. But around the world, a majority of people are not able to easily process milk, and it's not as popular in Japan, and that among Asian Americans, you know, being lactose intolerant is about as common as being right-handed. And yet our school meal programs require milk to be offered. It's the only food that's required to be offered, you know, food or beverage of any kind that's required to be offered to kids.
Talking to Peter Robison with Bloomberg News, talking about his piece on school lunches, the political influence of agricultural producers and dairy in particular. Peter, the dairy story in schools doesn't end with the milk that kids drink. There were sodium limitations put on under the Obama administration, and that started to have a spillover effect, right, on other dairy products.
That's right, because cheese is high in sodium, and another way that the dairy industry was about to be squeezed by the coming restrictions that had been set under the Obama administration was that the sodium levels, which had already dropped under those rules, were going to drop again, and they were going to nearly drop in half by 2025. And that was a big, according to, you know, food consultants I talked to, that was a big deal because that was going to severely restrict the amount of cheese. I mean, one person I talked to described it as kind of a cheese apocalypse. You'd have, you know, macaroni and cheese, cheeseburgers. Those would just not be on the menu as much. And so this easing of the coming sodium restrictions was something that the School Nutrition Association had pushed for, and it was something that they got.
Now, at the core of a lot of the arguments over schools is, okay, great, you put healthier food in, but are kids going to eat it? It is possible to make high-fiber, low-sodium, low-fat food that tastes good. It's really easy to make those kinds of foods that taste bad. What are we seeing when it comes to whether kids are eating the healthier, theoretically healthier stuff that's being put in front of them?
You are seeing some improvements there. Initially, when the changes were made in the Obama administration, you had a lot of the kids. The industry wasn't ready for the changes, so you had a lot of bland meals being served, and you had kids posting pictures of their terrible meals. But there were signs that has been improving, and in many school districts that I talked to, they said what was planned is just fine, and they were going to continue. And there were waivers that were offered to different schools that allowed them to serve more white breads or other kind of specialty or other meals that they thought would be palatable to kids.
Now take us to right now under the Trump administration. What are the guidelines for schools when it comes to their school lunches?
Right now, it's not. I wouldn't call it a rollback or a change that should make parents deeply concerned. What's happened is that the progress that had been made has been halted, but it has changed in the fact that 1% chocolate milk is now allowed, and the improvements that had been planned are not coming. The other change that we haven't talked about is in grains, that the Obama targets had required 100% of the foods to be whole grain rich, and the new target is 50% whole grain rich. So that could mean more pizzas, more white breads.
Now, when I look at one kid's lunch, it doesn't seem like a big deal. When I look at all the kids in the country's lunches over an entire 180-day school year, it starts to add up. Can you talk about the kind of money that's at stake in these issues?
It's a lot of money. It's the National School Lunch Program is about $13.6 billion a year for the milk industry. It's one industry source I found is that it's about 7.6% of all total fluid milk sales that comes from these feeding programs, as they're called, and that's and the thing about it is that it's a steady every year source of revenue at a time when the industry is really under pressure because people aren't drinking as much milk. I talked to the guy who came up with the Got Milk ads, and he said, he kind of threw up his hands and he said, I don't think a millennial is ever going to drink a glass of cold milk.
Can you talk about the lobbying that goes on from different sectors of the agriculture industry when it comes to setting these school guidelines?
Well, the lobbying comes through meetings and comments. The rulemaking is made, and then industries are allowed to write in comments. And a group like the School Nutrition Association has really had Sonny Perdue's ear. The president of that group began meeting with him very soon after he was confirmed, and Sonny Perdue went to their annual meeting after he had announced the changes, and was accepted as someone who had the industry side.
I want to take a last minute for a unique event. I think it was that same annual meeting of the School Nutrition Association. I had no idea this goes on. Directors of school lunch programs around the country go to this convention and talk about how the companies try to sell them on stuff.
Yeah, it's an amazing sight. You go to this annual meeting, and it's thousands of lunch ladies, for lack of a better word, because they're cooks, cafeteria managers, and they attend meetings about the requirements in school in lunches, and it is quite complicated, the regulations. But they also hear something called a culinary demo, and in these demos, it's an opportunity for the food companies to directly pitch them. I went to one where that Land O'Lakes had hosted, and a sort of Food Network celebrity chef named Jason Smith talked about recipes that they should consider, and lo and behold, they were all cheese recipes. Cheesy cowboy meatball hoagie, Cuban mac and cheese sandwich, cheesy peas salad. He said, "Girl, get your head in that bowl and lick her clean when it's done." He was just a charming guy who had people in stitches, and ultimately it was about making sure cheese has its place on the lunch tray.
Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Peter Robison is a writer for Bloomberg News and Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. He wrote the piece, "Big Dairy is About to Flood America's School Lunches with Milk." A nearly two-minute ad from the men's shaving company Gillette has been getting a lot of attention. It falls into the category of social awareness advertising, when a brand takes on a social issue and builds a campaign around it.
The issue in this ad is what some people call toxic masculinity and how men perpetuate it. Here's a little bit of how it sounds.
Bullying.
The Me Too movement against sexual harassment.
Toxic masculinity.
Is this the best a man can get? Is it?
It's likely happening here in
bullying as well. A problem.
We can't hide from it.
Sexual harassment is taking over.
It's been going on far too long.
There are scenes of boys bullying other boys, men harassing women, and towards the end, other men stepping up to stop the bad behavior. Our next guest says that framing makes sense, but if we really want to change toxic masculinity, we also need to look at how women contribute to it.
Monica Hesse is a columnist for the Washington Post, where she writes about gender and society. Her latest column is titled, "How Should Conversations About Toxic Masculinity Deal with the Toxic Women Who Also Perpetuate It?" Monica, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, for some of us who really don't know this term very well, what exactly is toxic masculinity?
I think that you could ask four different people and get four different definitions for what it is, because some men see it as an insulting term implying that being a man is toxic and there's something wrong with being a man. When I hear the term, I think of a systemic problem that has created a pattern of beliefs and bad behaviors in some masculinity, in some expressions of masculinity. And because it's a systemic problem, I think that there needs to be a systemic solution rather than just addressing a few men to change how they behave.
Is it just the name, or should it be something that should be rephrased?
You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with the term as it was envisioned. Again, it's not saying all men are toxic. It's saying that there's a problem with some expressions of traditional masculinity. But it's a term that's become enough of a buzzword that some people are going to have a negative reaction to it immediately as soon as you start discussing it. And I think that that's where you start to wonder, is there a way we can talk about this differently to invite more people into the conversation rather than turning them off immediately?
What was the Gillette ad trying to say about the issue of toxic masculinity?
I think that what the ad was trying to say is that there are a lot of patterns that we now look away from or excuse as boys will be boys. So some forms of bullying or name-calling or physical altercations, we just sort of roll our eyes and say, well, that's how boys are. And I think that what the Gillette ad was trying to say is that's not how boys are. Boys can be caring and sensitive and look out for each other in really positive ways. And so let's reframe the message to that. Let's invite men to dismiss those stereotypes and say boys will be boys doesn't have to refer to boys pulling girls' hair on the playground. It can refer to boys having conversations and standing up for each other and standing up for women.
In your column, you point out that maybe the ad should have had bigger roles for women in it. Explain that a little bit.
You know, I think that, again, we're not talking about bad things that individual men do. Just like in the Me Too movement that arose last year, we weren't talking about specific men who did specific bad things always. We were talking about office cultures that might have looked the other way in terms of sexual harassment, or an entertainment industry that made it possible for this to happen to lots of women. So the bad actors who support these outdated opinions aren't always men. I receive a lot of reader emails. I'm a columnist, and so my inbox is always full. And it's really interesting to me when I receive emails from men saying, I do think that negative stereotypes are reinforced about men, and it's not always the men who are doing them. One reader wrote me saying, the parent who always told me, boys don't cry, you better buck up, wasn't my father, it was my mother. Or a man who wrote in saying, I've never cried in front of my wife because the one time that I did, she got really uncomfortable and left the room. So I think that we all need to be a part of the conversation of, if we think these patterns are dangerous, how can we all be a part of breaking them and examine the way that we might perpetuate them, intentionally or not?
Monica Hesse is a columnist for The Washington Post, where she writes about gender and society. Her latest column is titled, How Should Conversations About Toxic Masculinity Deal with the Toxic Women Who Also Perpetuate It? And we're talking about, in particular, the Gillette commercial and the response to that. You talked about some of the emails that you've gotten from men talking about how women have enforced the ideas of traditional masculinity. One of the things that I've heard from other men too is talking about the fact that when a girl comes home and says, Johnny pulled my hair, and the response is that's because he likes you. Did you also get those kind of stories too?
Yeah, sure. I think that this is one of the points that I try to make in a lot of these discussions, that this is a system that is that's really bad for all of us, because when a young girl hears he's only pulling your hair because he likes you, what she learns is he's allowed to do what he wants. It's I'm not allowed to complain about it. It's like, oh, I guess that affection is the same as torment. And boys learn that too. They learn that if you like someone, the way to show that is to continue to harass her and pester her and not take no for an answer. So these are really unhealthy messages for boys and girls. And again, the he's only doing it because he likes you is something that that I'm sure men say too, but also that I heard a lot of mothers say to their daughters and continue to say to their daughters.
One of the things that I noticed in the commercial after watching it is the prominent role that African-American men played in it. Oftentimes, what you saw in the commercial was of African-American men stepping in to either stop someone from you know, saying something that was inappropriate or doing something that was inappropriate. You had a scene that's also on YouTube of a young African-American man talking to his infant daughter in the mirror. You saw a lot of that. And then you also saw some backlash, too, from white men saying that they were portrayed in a bad light as well. Did you also get emails talking about that dynamic?
I got one email, and the way that it was phrased was very black and white, because this man, the reader who emailed me, said there are absolutely no good white men in this commercial and absolutely no good black men, or no bad black men. And I encouraged him to watch the commercial again and then email me again and you know, to please watch it closely. And when he wrote back, he said, oh, actually, there's a scene where a white man goes over and breaks up a fight between two little kids and tells them we don't treat each other like that. And, oh, I guess now that I'm looking more closely, there's a scene where a lot of men are lined up against barbecue grills chanting boys will be boys, you know, in a negative way. And some of those men are men of color. So I saw that sort of back. But I think that if you rewatch the ad, you'll sort of see that that's not a factually accurate complaint.
We're talking to Monica Hesse, style columnist for The Washington Post, about her recent column entitled, How Should Conversations About Toxic Masculinity Deal with the Toxic Women Who Also Perpetuate It?
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found yourself saying that excusing behavior for boys with the phrase, boys will be boys? Maybe you've gotten uncomfortable when you've been around a man in your life when he is willing to share emotions. Maybe you're a man who's been on the receiving end of that for a man or woman in your life. How did that make you feel? What do you think about how some boys and men are treated differently for showing emotion? What was your reaction to this Gillette ad? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org.
We'll continue this conversation here on Central Time after this short break. This is Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Monica Hesse. She's a columnist with The Washington Post. She's with us to talk about the role women and men can play in preventing the issues raised by what's called toxic masculinity.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this treatment of boys and men in your own family? Maybe you grew up with it or have experienced it as an adult. Have you ever noticed yourself saying things that enforce traditional ideas of masculinity? Or are you someone who's open to seeing men be more vulnerable? If you're a man, what role models have you had that have shown you how to be your own kind of man? Call 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Daniel in Milwaukee. Good afternoon, Daniel. Welcome to Central Time.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. So I spent a lot of time in the Army, and I'm a huge fan of fighting toxic masculinity, and I'm a huge fan of bystander intervention. I think they're really important things that particularly the armed forces are starting to come around to. And so I guess, you know, like in my life now with daughters, I try to work on not letting, you know, family members guilt them into giving them hugs and kisses when they don't want to. And I try to implement some of these things in my life as a father. But I guess the issue I have is the APA's using the definition of toxic masculinity and then defining that as traditional masculinity is the cultural piece that I see as problematic, and where people might feel like the positive attributes of masculinity are under attack. And I think the APA historically has been utilized by, I'll say, culture warriors on both sides to get outcomes they want through definitions. We saw that with, calling, you know, non-heterosexual behavior as, you know, variety of manias and mental illnesses. And so I'm interested in your comments on that.
Thank you for the call, Daniel. What are your thoughts, Monica, about, first of all, bystander intervention? And it seems to be that's one of the biggest things that the Gillette commercial was trying to promote.
First of all, this caller sounds like an amazing parent. I'm so glad you're raising daughters. You seem like an amazing father. I think that in terms of bystander intervention, I feel like what the commercial is trying to do is to say that it means a lot when someone calls out bad behavior. It means a lot to the victim. It's something that we can all practice in our own lives, and it's something that can be as simple as, you know, if you see someone being harassed on the bus, moving over and sitting next to the person who's being harassed and striking up a conversation just to let them know, you know, I'm here in your corner. I'm listening to what's happening with you. I thought that the caller's points about traditional masculinity and the APA guidelines were really interesting, and that is something that I've done a little research on, so I could comment on that if that would be useful.
Oh, absolutely.
So again, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not affiliated with the APA at all, but I did write a column about these guidelines and talked with several of the researchers who had done the research and who had originated this work. I think that the term traditional masculinity is a really confusing term because it sounds like, you know, what are you saying? Are you saying traditional men are no good? I heard that term, and I immediately thought of my grandfather, who's a very traditional man in the sense that he was a soldier, and then he volunteered with the fire department, and he drove a garbage truck. He was very, very stoic and a good provider and all of that. What the guidelines are saying is not that that is bad. My grandfather was a great man, is a great man, and I would hate for anyone to think differently. What the guidelines are trying to say is that some of the traits that we associate with traditional masculinity, like stoicism or dominance or a individualism or the ability, the belief that you shouldn't ask for help, those can be really great, useful traits in smaller doses. They can be useful traits for both men and women. Where we run into problems are when men don't feel like they have the right to be anything else. When men feel like they must be stoic, or they're not a real man, or they must do it on their own, or they're not a real man. And when there's an over-reliance on those neutral traits or those positive traits, that's when we run into trouble. That's partially why men have such higher instances of suicide than women do, because when there's an over-reliance on these traits, they can lash out at others or lash in at themselves.
Monica Hesse joins us. She's a columnist for The Washington Post, and we are talking about what role women play in reinforcing toxic masculinity on the heels of the recent Gillette commercial. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Harley in Manitowoc. Hello, Harley. Welcome to Central Time.
Hello, and thank you. I wanted to call in because a lot of times when we're talking about gender, we forget to look at the LGBT community, especially the trans community. I'm a trans woman, and I know for me, growing up in the 90s and the 2000s, toxic masculinity left me in my closet until I was 25, 26, and I was finally had the courage to come out to start exploring that because I kept getting told all these boy traits. And I think that's one group of people that get missed and how much this truly hurts them because we kept getting pigeonholed into these toxic binaries that don't allow us to explore ourselves.
Thank you for the call, Harley. And Harley is exactly right. One of the things that we often do forget about is the LGBT community, in particular, the trans community. So how does toxic masculinity affect those communities?
I think that obviously the transgender community is already so vulnerable in areas of discrimination and in areas of abuse. And I think that this is just another layer of difficulty that gets heaped on them when people are saying, not only you can't be yourself, but also you must be this very narrow definition of what a boy is or of what a girl is. One of the most thoughtful emails that I've gotten in response to this column was from a woman who's in a same-sex relationship, raising a boy with her wife, and she said that what stuck out to her is that she realized that even she has used phrases like, "Oh, my son is all boy," because he's very boisterous and because he plays with trucks or things like that, and that she was sort of chagrined to think that this had even permeated her own way of thinking, and that she was going to be cognizant of making clear that if her son wanted to play with trucks and be boisterous, that was great. If that's who he was, that was great. But that she was going to try not to peg those characteristics necessarily to his gender. She was going to try to peg them to his personality.
Unfortunately, we only have just a few minutes left, so I won't be able to get a chance to get to this phone call. But I do want to mention that Gwen in Madison had said that young girls being sexualized in media and culture, but then telling young men not to look or touch, should be part of the conversation as well. What are your thoughts on that?
I really couldn't disagree more. I think that it's important to not sexualize young girls, but I also think that people of all genders should be raised with the expectation that that they need to keep their hands and their eyes to themselves. And so I'm uncomfortable with any with anything that starts to sound like, if you're going to wear X, then you deserve Y. I just don't think that that's a productive path for us to go down.
And with about 30 seconds left, how can men push back when women consciously or unconsciously say things that perpetuate these ideas?
I think that all humans deserve to have feelings. And I think that I think that the conversation has to start there. You know, I deserve to be able to be sad. I deserve to be able to be vulnerable. Every human, male, female, non-binary, deserves to have the same wide spectrum of feelings.
Monica, thank you so much for joining us. That was Monica Hesse, style columnist for The Washington Post. She was with us to talk about the idea of toxic masculinity and what role women have in it.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, how do opioid drugs get into the United States? A big question in the border security debate. A drug policy expert answers that question. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.